Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm David Borax, the climate reporter at WFAE in Charlotte.
Hurricane Florence is making landfall after thrashing the Carolinas all night long.
The center of Florence is near Wilmington, North Carolina, with maximum sustained winds of 90
miles. The death toll is climbing.
The world and the Carolinas are coming to terms with climate change. More intense storms, extreme heat, droughts, floods, sometimes even when the sun is shining. All of these concern Kathy Dello, an atmospheric scientist and North Carolina's state climatologist.
Climate change is here and now in North Carolina. It's not a future problem. It's not a far-off problem. It's affecting our friends and neighbors here where we live. And it's hurting the frontline communities first and worst.
Dello's office supplies the science that's helping state policymakers figure out how to tackle climate change, both reducing the carbon dioxide emissions that are causing it and building resilience against its effects like heat and flooding. That's our topic this hour. It used to be that we debated the reality of climate change, but now 72% of Americans believe global warming is happening, and nearly as many are worried about it, according to the Yale University survey of climate opinion. Now the debate is over what to do about it. Susan Joy Hassel is an Asheville-based climate communicator.
People are more convinced than ever that this is a crisis that we need to deal with, and people are willing to deal with it. They want to deal with it. It's going to require system change.
So why have opinions shifted?
We can see climate change playing out right outside our front door and our front window in our headlines every day.
That's why states, local governments, and even companies are adopting goals for reducing carbon emissions and spending millions on adapting. We're putting up solar panels, switching to electric vehicles, and planning for offshore wind energy. Last year's North Carolina Energy Reform Law commits the state to cutting carbon emissions at power plants by shifting to clean energy. State utility regulators have until the end of the year to adopt a plan. Climate and environmental justice advocate William Barber III says we need to address the inequities of climate change as we do this.
When we look at the data holistically, it tells us a story that the people who are facing the immediate impacts of the global climate crisis are largely people of color, largely in the southeastern United States, and largely poor. So that necessitates that we have to have all solutions on the table when we talk about carbon reduction and actually securing meaningful investments in clean energy, as well as accelerating a just transition to a clean economy.
That's why discussing climate change is so important. One of the biggest challenges for climate scientists is communicating to the public. The field is chock full of complicated calculations and jargon, but as Blue Ridge Public Radio's Helen Chickering found out, it's not necessarily the big words and phrases that are the problem.
If you've heard or read a recent climate report, perhaps caught the headlines in the news, chances are some of those words were edited by Tom Maycock. He's a science editor with NC State University's Institute for Climate Studies based in Asheville. Maycock is part of a vast network of science writers and editors who work behind the scenes helping climate scientists organize and translate their data and research findings into reports that are read by everyone from the president to the public.
And really what I do is help the scientists who are authoring those reports try to frame their language in a way that is more accessible, but also as accurate and precise as it can be.
It's a challenging job, and while the wordy technical terms are the obvious culprits, a recent study suggests there's another not-so-obvious layer of jargon that needs the editor's attention. Researchers with the United Nations Foundation and the University of Southern California tested the public's knowledge on some uncomplicated terms that show up in climate science reports. USC's Wendy Bruin de Bruin was the lead author on the study.
And so the words that they selected were like adaptation, mitigation, sustainable development, words that you may or may not have heard before, but they're used in a lot of climate change communications.
The study findings suggest these fairly simple-sounding words and terms are an overlooked source of confusion and misinterpretation.
Even if people thought that some of those terms were easy to understand, didn't necessarily mean that they actually defined those words in the way that climate scientists would.
And that's a problem, says veteran science climate communicator Susan Joy Hassel, who for years has been collecting such words she dubs a different kind of jargon.
It's words that people do understand. They just understand them to mean something completely different. So, for example, to the public, positive is good and negative is bad. But in climate science, they don't use the terms that way. Positive is upward. So they'll talk about a positive trend in temperature. The public thinks that sounds good, right? It's not. In the era of global warming, a positive trend in temperature is bad.
The definition disconnect is a pet peeve that Hassel has turned into a public service campaign. We tapped into her expertise to help clear some of that climate word confusion, starting with the very common term greenhouse gas.
If the public hears a term like greenhouse gases, they don't know what that means. It kind of depends on them understanding the metaphor of a greenhouse for global warming. I like to call it heat-trapping pollution rather than greenhouse gases because heat-trapping tells you the mechanism. These things trap heat. So carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases act like a blanket. They hold heat in Earth's atmosphere.
You mentioned carbon dioxide. I feel like that's another one, carbon. We say it a lot, but do we really understand what it means in terms of climate change?
Carbon is an element, letter C on the periodic table. Carbon dioxide is the heat-trapping gas that is the most important one that humans are producing through our activities, the burning of coal, oil, and gas, and the clearing of forests. People have sort of shorthanded carbon dioxide into carbon. So what's your carbon footprint? It's really your carbon dioxide footprint. How much CO2 are you producing?
What about carbon neutral? We hear that a lot.
Carbon neutral means you don't emit more carbon dioxide than you can take up. So we know that trees take up carbon dioxide. We know that we're emitting much more carbon dioxide than the trees on Earth can take up. So we need to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we're emitting to the level that the trees and the oceans and the other, we call them sinks for carbon, can take up. That's the way Earth stores carbon. It's another one of these words that mean different things, right? When you hear sink, you think of that vessel where you wash dishes. What scientists are talking about with carbon sinks are places where carbon is stored in the soil, in vegetation, in trees, in the oceans. Those are carbon sinks. So we want to balance the sources and the sinks so that we're no longer putting in more carbon dioxide than we're taking up.
What about mitigation? We hear that a lot too.
Yeah, I once had a washing machine hose burst and flooded my house. I called a flood mitigation service. They came in after the fact and cleaned up the mess. So that's not at all what we mean when we use it that way around climate change. We mean to proactively reduce future climate change. But the public uses it in a different way. We use it to mean clean up or reduce the impact of in any way. And I sometimes have to remind my scientist colleagues that not everyone knows what we mean when we say that. So let's just say reduce future climate change instead of mitigation.
It's a message that's not lost on science editor Tom Maycock.
So I think those are terms we need to be very careful about explaining and sometimes just avoiding. If you mean reducing emissions, just say reducing emissions.
Maycock helped edit North Carolina's 2020 climate science report, which includes a plain language summary and the phrase heat-trapping gases. Reporting in Asheville, I'm Helen Chickering.
A river of water rushes off a glacier and into the sea in Greenland. It's a few thousand miles from the Carolinas, but you can't talk about sea level rise here without it. Tony Bartlemy is senior projects reporter at the Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. Last year, he and photographer Lauren Petraka traveled to Greenland for an award-winning project called the Greenland Connection. They captured the intensity of the melt and drew a line between Greenland's melting glaciers and sea level rise in Charleston and the Carolinas. I asked Tony about the project.
What's happening in Greenland is actually the most important thing to know about in terms of what's going to happen to our city in the future for a bunch of reasons. And it kind of begins with how Greenland is this essentially this giant slab of ice on top of land. Just like when you drop an ice cube into a whiskey drink, you know, if you drop too many ice cubes into that drink, you know what happens? It spills. And that's kind of exactly what's happening in Greenland. You know, this giant ice sheet the size of Mexico is essentially melting and moving into the ocean, raising our sea level just like an ice cube does. Greenland also has this weird gravitational effect on our tides, even this far away. This ice sheet is so dense and so massive that it actually has a gravitational pull that pulls the ocean toward it. And at the end of that gravitational pull, it pulls the ocean away from us, lowering our sea level. So as that gravitational pull diminishes as the ice melts, so does that sea sort of slosh back. And nobody's really talking about that that effect, the Greenland connection. So we went to Greenland last summer at the height of the summer melt, and then we tried to bring back, you know, all these weird factors that are affecting Greenland, but really also directly affecting our city's fate.
Is there anything that you saw there that kind of moved you or made you realize that this is really an important story?
There were a couple of things. One of them was going into what they call the ice fjord and seeing these giant icebergs, again, essentially these giant ice cubes that fell off the ice sheet. And these icebergs were the size of mountains, islands. And just seeing this, the sheer scale of that was very moving. And then also hiking onto the ice sheet, you know, we hired a guide and we strapped on metal crampons and hiked into the ice sheet. And just to experience that actual melting, you know, below your feet, and knowing that this is happening on such a massive scale also was very moving. And then also finally, when we were there, it rained and it rained hard on top of the ice sheet. And it normally doesn't do that. It's too cold. But because of a rapidly warming climate, in one science station, they saw rain for the first time in recorded history.
Just an amazing story and an amazing trip. I should note that your story won an award this year from the Society of Environmental Journalists for Outstanding Explanatory Reporting. Congratulations on that. And I wanted to ask you, how did this story come about?
Yeah, David, you know, why on earth would a newspaper send two journalists 3,000 miles away to write about climate change happening in South Carolina? So I was working on another story about 5 years ago. It was about how the Gulf Stream is slowing down. And it was in the middle of the summer and the boss comes over to me and I say, you know, it's so hot that, you know, I really need to go to Greenland to do this story right. And he said, oh yeah, you're just trying to go on a trip on the company's nickel. And, you know, there's a little grain of truth in that. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized when you take into account what's happening with the Gulf Stream, you take into account all these factors, what's happening in Greenland is really the most important factor in our city's future.
Tony, thanks so much.
You bet.
Tony Bartlemy is senior projects reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. He reported the Greenland connection with his colleague Lauren Petraka last year. You're listening to ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm climate reporter David Borex. When we come back, we'll hear more about extreme heat, sea level rise, and how climate change is affecting agriculture in the Carolinas.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is a special report, ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm climate reporter David Borex. So what do melting glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica, for that matter, mean for us in practical terms? In February, federal climate scientists warned that sea level rise is accelerating, posing a more immediate threat than previously thought to coastal areas of the Carolinas and nationwide. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, projects ocean levels along the U.S. coast will rise an average of 10 to 12 inches by 2050. That's as much as the total increase over the past 100 years. Nicole LaBeouf of NOAA's National Ocean Service told reporters,
"By 2050, moderate flooding, flooding that typically damages property and commerce, is expected to occur 10 times as often as it does today."
NOAA officials said in a separate report in August that so-called sunny day flooding will multiply over the next 30 years in coastal communities. That's when higher seas coupled with high tides bring flooding even when there's no storm feeding them, places like Wilmington and Charleston and the Outer Banks. Most of these places had almost no high tide floods in 2000, but that's no longer true. Oregon Inlet Marina on the Outer Banks had 5 days of high tide flooding last year. With sea levels expected to rise another foot by 2050, that could increase to 110 to 155 days a year, according to NOAA projections. Wilmington will increase from about 8 days last year to 70 to 100 days a year. Charleston will go from 7 days to 70 to 90 days. And that's just measuring the most extreme floods. Some places in Charleston flood more often at lower levels. NOAA oceanographer William Sweet says high tide flood days may become the new high tide in many locations.
"This is information needed to protect life, property, the economy, and our environment for future generations. For the first time in human history, the infrastructure we build must be designed and constructed with future conditions in mind."
Infrastructure is expensive and requires planning. In Charleston, they're even contemplating a $1 billion-plus seawall to protect against storm surges that will get worse as sea levels rise. And when you plan a project like that, it can get complicated pretty quickly. A Charleston seawall may keep water out of the Battery in downtown, but that water has to go somewhere. Carly Town worries it will come to her neighborhood of Union Heights in North Charleston. I visited her last year.
"The seawall is interesting because that may affect us, because that seawall is going to come all the way around, but it's the hike is right there, you know, right at the tip. So that surge may create, with climate change and all that, more issues. So yeah, we are trying to identify, is it going to be really good for them to do that?"
When we solve one problem, do we create another? Sea level rise is also a problem at the beach. On the heavily developed barrier islands of the Carolinas, it's a constant battle between Mother Nature and engineers. We're spending millions of dollars a year to rebuild beaches, only to have the sea take them back. Engineers say it may not be sustainable, and scientists say it makes no sense environmentally. I visited Ocean Isle Beach on North Carolina's southeast coast last spring to learn more. A slurry of water and sand pumps out of a rusty 30-inch pipe running about a mile and a half along Ocean Isle Beach. Bulldozers level and shape the sand to rebuild the shrunken beach. Rolando Serrano is a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers construction engineer.
"This sand is being dug from the inlet area portion of the island, and it's being pumped hydraulically to this point where it's discharged."
The Army Corps of Engineers and town officials spent $8.7 million to rebuild the beach. It had narrowed and sloped off during storms and high tides since the last replenishment 4 years ago. This was the sixth in a series of projects going back 20 years. The Army Corps manages these projects under 50-year contracts that have to justify the expense. That will get harder to do with climate change, says Bob Kiesler, the Army Corps project manager.
"In theory, if sea level rise goes to a high level, these projects are going to be hard to justify in the future."
Town officials say beach renourishment is critical to the town's economy. Dean Walters is the mayor pro tem.
"The beach is the golden egg at Ocean Isle Beach. Through projects like this, you know, we're able to maintain the property values, we're a place for people to come and visit. It's one of our key projects for the whole year."
Altogether, federal, state, and local governments have spent more than $1 billion on North Carolina beach renourishment since the 1950s, adjusted for inflation. Stan Riggs is a coastal geologist at East Carolina University. He says the barrier islands naturally want to shift and doesn't think the sand replacement is sustainable over the long term.
if we don't acknowledge what's happening, the economy on the barrier islands is not going to survive. We can do it for a while, but the shoreline keeps moving. The shore gets steeper and steeper.
But even as scientists raise warning flags, communities keep pumping sand at skyrocketing costs. The town of Oak Island, about 20 miles east, spent $29 million in local and federal money over the past 2 years to repair its beach from damage by Hurricanes Matthew in 2015 and Florence in 2018. Diana and Nelson Barris are grateful for the work. They think it's worth the cost, even if it means a tax increase, says Diana Barris.
I would. I mean, sure. I mean, of course I would like, you know, state and federal to help, but yeah, I mean, I would be game. I mean, hey, we have an investment, you know, so if it means, you know, raising everyone's taxes, I mean.
The question is how long we can afford to keep battling Mother Nature. Overhead fans are blowing on a steamy afternoon at the roof above Homeless Services Day Center near Uptown Charlotte. Sunny, low 90s, hot. One of the buildings, an old train depot, has a broad overhang shading people sitting on benches. Kendall Jackson is one of several dozen people seeking shade here. He says he's not bothered by the heat and knows what to do.
I mean, you better find a tree or something or go inside, get some AC, drink some water.
But heat can mean trouble for unsheltered people. Roof Above added equipment to help on hot days when people can't go inside, says spokesman Randall Hitt.
You can see in both the front side and the back side, we have a series of large fans that once the temperature hits a certain threshold, those kick on. And then built into those fans, we have misting units.
Misting units like the kind you see at amusement parks. The center also has outdoor water stations where people can drink, refill their water bottles, and wash their hands. And across the driveway, another building has basic services and air conditioning, but it's not open all day.
We call this the hub. This is the building where all of our basic services are delivered, where people can come in and get their mail. This is where they take their showers, do their laundry, come in and get lunch. So as you can see, the main building is seating, so people can come in and at least get a respite from the weather.
Public cooling services like these will become more important as global temperatures rise. Researchers at the First Street Foundation in New York say the number of dangerously hot days will multiply across the U.S. over the next 30 years because of global warming, even in normally cooler areas like the North Carolina mountains. In Charlotte and Raleigh, the hottest 7 days now have a heat index, that's a feels-like temperature combining heat and humidity, of more than 104 degrees. That will increase to 17 days by 2053. In Charleston, South Carolina, the number of 105-degree heat index days will nearly triple, says First Street's Jeremy Porter.
The way to phrase it, your hottest week in Charleston is going to become about your hottest 3 weeks in Charleston in 30 years.
But these temperatures aren't experienced in the same way, even in the same city. Low-income communities of color in urban areas are more likely to experience extreme heat because of historically unequal policies and investment around development and zoning. These so-called urban heat islands are a fact of life and a challenge for policymakers in cities across the Carolinas. WUNC reporter Celeste Gracia has more about a federal study that looked at the urban heat island effect in Raleigh and Durham.
In July 2021, over 100 volunteers collected heat data along 19 different routes three separate times over the course of a single day. People walked, biked, and drove all over Raleigh and Durham to collect almost 100,000 individual measurements. The results showed a maximum temperature difference of 9.6 degrees between the hottest and coolest areas in Raleigh and a maximum temperature difference of 10.4 degrees in Durham. A main reason for these differences is land use. Max Colley is with the Durham Museum of Life and Science and was a lead organizer of this project.
What we know about complex urban environments is that it has to do with things like hard, dark surfaces that not only make areas hotter during the heat of the day, but absorb that heat and hold on to it for longer and then radiate that heat back out as the rest of the city is cooling. And on the other hand, areas with more tree canopy coverage, more green space, these areas stay cooler. They have ecosystem services provided by the green space there.
Low-income people and people of color are more likely to live in the neighborhoods with higher temperatures. Historical redlining plays a big role in that.
Those decisions that were made about how we plan our cities really boiled down to racist, segregationist, and otherwise exclusionary urban planning tactics. Things like homeowners loan corporation redlining that deemed that some areas were safe for investment and some areas were dangerous for investment, explicitly off of the racial makeup of these different neighborhoods.
Local government officials are now using this study to address some of these inequities. Tobin Freed is the sustainability manager for Durham County. She says this study is being taken into consideration as the county updates its comprehensive plan.
Environmental issues are just woven through all. It's really thinking more holistically as opposed to housing as its own silo and environment as one silo. And this urban heat island information is being integrated into that as well of how do we design our community in a way to minimize urban heat island and to make sure that equity issues are really considered.
This information can also help local officials better decide where to plant more trees, open public cooling stations, or install shaded bus stops. It's also being worked into Durham County's Hazard Mitigation Plan for Emergency Management. The study was part of a National Urban Heat Island Mapping Campaign by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Charleston, South Carolina also participated and found a maximum temperature difference of 11.8 degrees in their city. I'm Celeste Gracia.
This isn't just about feeling uncomfortable. It's about public health. The more high heat days we have and the longer the heat waves, the more people will get sick and die. It's an invisible symptom of climate change that will only become more visible.
Extreme heat likely kills more people in the United States than any other climate or weather-related event. And more than hurricanes on an annual basis, more than floods, severe storms. And that's because extreme heat events occur everywhere.
That's Jesse Bell, director of the Water, Climate, and Health Program at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Bell helped lead a study of emergency room visits during heat waves in North Carolina. It found that about 15% of heat-related emergency department visits are directly attributable to climate change, illnesses such as heat stress and heat exhaustion that increase when temperatures get above 30 degrees Celsius, 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Researchers hope local officials will use all this data to improve our response to deadly heat emergencies. Extreme weather is a challenge for one of the state's biggest industries, agriculture. As WFDD's Carrie Brown reports, farmers in Guilford County are finding ways to adapt.
It's a muggy late summer day at Freedom House Farm in Summerfield. They've decided to open early. And Stephen Farrell, the farm manager, takes his tractor out into the field. Here they grow fruits and vegetables, and their main crop is strawberries. Farrell says a lot goes into making it all work.
The worse the weather, that first strawberry becomes more beautiful, you know, that you made it through.
Some berries like heat, Farrell says, but there's a downside to what they've been seeing lately.
The high temperatures can bring in more pests, so the last 2 years we have seen more like beetles, Japanese beetles, on the produce and the blackberries. And there's really not much you can do about that.
Excessive rains can also negatively impact a crop, causing disease and fungus. One thing Farrell can do is to add moisture if needed. He says they installed a drip irrigation system to help during the growing seasons.
There's maybe 1% of everything we do out here and all the hours that we're working and the sweat and the labor that you can actually control. So I think you just have to be able to be flexible with whatever that weather change is.
Guilford County Cooperative Extension agent Ben Grandin says these days many farmers are opting for crop insurance or rotating crops to protect their profitability window. But things are still hard to predict.
The storms come through the county, but it seems like one block it's raining really hard, you go a quarter mile away and it's bone dry. So it hasn't been consistent rains as far as overall coverage, leading to struggles getting the crops up and getting them really to get to that full maturity and full vigor.
While some farmers say extreme weather and farming has always been an issue, Researchers at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University say these types of weather conditions have become more common in the state. Biswanath Dhari, an agriculture and extension specialist with North Carolina A&T, says you have to look at both weather patterns, which are short-term, and climate, which is long-term.
The sad news is climate is actually changing. Over a decade and long-term, the climate is changing in North Carolina in terms of sea level rise, storm, hurricanes, excessive flooding, extreme rainfall, the more hotter night, hot night, and the hot temperature in the daytime.
Dhari says this has a direct impact on agriculture. That's why experts think more technologies and practices that are tailored to the farming operation are needed. North Carolina A&T focuses on helping small, limited resource and minority farmers find ways to thrive and meet challenges, which is important because small-scale farms are a large part of the state's industry. The university partnered with the Environmental Defense Fund to do case studies on three farms in North Carolina. They looked at what strategies made financial and environmental sense. Three top solutions emerged. The first, high tunnels, which are greenhouse-like structures without a heater that can extend the growing season. Second, cover crops. These are plants that are grown but not sold that help with drainage and soil quality. And lastly, reduced tillage of farmland. Dhari says all of these are important for building resilience to climate change.
You do not just have to think about your crop yield or farm income. You have to think about your environment as well.
There are other climate studies being done on North Carolina A&T's nearly 500-acre research farm. One of the goals is to find new varieties of fruit trees and plants that can better withstand warmer winters. They're also looking at climate impact on livestock. Regardless of the findings, it's agreed that updates and changes to farming will require more investment at a time when farmers are already experiencing some limited resources. Across Guilford County and Gibsonville, Edward Apple of Apple Farms is arranging produce crates for his farmer's market stand. He's been in the industry for nearly 30 years. Farming runs in his blood, going back to his great-grandfather. And it's all of that experience, he says, that will help him weather future storms.
Being a farmer, I mean, that's what I do. And if it's a good day, it's a bad day, doesn't really matter. I'll be back tomorrow.
Apple says he's doing his best through investments in his land to make sure his farm is productive, healthy, and is part of the community into the next generation. For WFDD, I'm Carrie Brown in Guilford County.
You're listening to ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm climate reporter David Borax. Coming up after a break, dealing with saltwater intrusion and flooding, and I'll talk with climate reporters from around the Carolinas about issues facing the region.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
You're listening to ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm climate reporter David Borax. Farmers on the North Carolina coast face a different set of worries when it comes to climate change. Rising sea levels, saltwater intrusion, and more intense storms are forcing some to adjust and even take some fields out of production. I visited Hyde County on the Pamlico Sound this spring with reporter John Upton of journalism and research nonprofit Climate Central. We're standing next to a field in Scranton in the western part of the county with farmer Ray Tooley. He farms about 5,000 acres here.
This is a 1 to 5 foot above sea level area. So as you can tell, being that low, sea level rise has a lot to do with what happens here.
Many of these fields were once wetlands, but were drained in the early 20th century for agriculture. The sea level has risen about a foot in the past century, bringing more frequent floods and saltwater intrusion. Saltwater creeps underground through the water table, but it also arrives with higher tides and washes over the land during storms. Most crops can't tolerate the salt, so in some areas, Tule has switched to cotton, which is more resilient.
It doesn't like it, but if you actually get a established stand of it, it can tolerate it and be a profitable crop.
Projections by Climate Central show that northeastern North Carolina will be a national hotspot for inland migration of wetlands during the coming decades as seas continue to rise. Hyde County could see almost 125,000 acres of new coastal wetlands by 2050, Another 50,000 acres of existing wetlands are expected to drown and become open water. So farmers are adapting. Besides changing what they plant, they're installing structures such as tide gates, which let rainwater flow off the fields to the ocean but hold back saltwater tides. And when salt does contaminate fields, farmers are turning to state and federal conservation programs that pay them to let those areas revert to wetlands. Farmer Earl Pugh on the east side of the county uses these programs.
On good land, the crops are a lot better than the conservation easement. Where your conservation easement, it looks enticing, is where you have marginal or land that doesn't produce very well.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture pays $100 to $200 an acre for conservation easements, well short of the $1,000 or more farmers could get if the land was still producing. The farmers and the county government have spent millions of dollars on dikes, canals, and tide gates, but it hasn't been enough, says Daniel Brin, Hyde County's flood control coordinator.
Farmers have just completely taken, you know, many thousands of acres out of production altogether because it's not viable to grow a crop there anymore.
The rising ocean is also a problem for other residents, like Leland Howard, who also lives in Scranton. He says high tides flood his backyard often.
Well, every evening, sometimes it'll come in and stay for 2 or 3 days, you know.
Hyde is among North Carolina's poorest counties. Between environmental hardships and other economic forces, the county has been losing population. Brin says sea level rise is a factor. As the cost of holding back the sea and salt water rises, those trends are only going to continue. You're listening to ADAPT, Changing Climate in the Carolinas. I'm WFAE climate reporter David Borax. I'm one of a growing number of journalists around the Carolinas who are covering the effects of climate change and how we're responding to it. Next, we'll talk with a few of those reporters about climate change and its challenges in the Carolinas. Joining me are Celeste Gracia, environment reporter at WUNC, Kerry Brown, reporter and host at WFDD, Ben Schachman, news director at WHQR, and Tony Bartlemy, senior projects reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston. Welcome, everybody. I wanted to start out first by setting the scene here. When it comes to climate change, what are some of the major stories that you and your colleagues have been covering in your communities? Tony, Charleston is in the news a lot because of things happening there. What are some of the big issues that you're facing? I know that sea level rise is a big issue there.
Yeah, David, it sure is. As you know, Charleston is in an area in South Carolina known as the Low Country, and that's well named. It's most of the land is just a few feet above sea level. So we're literally at the front lines of some of the most important effects of global warming: rising seas, heavier storms, more frequent storms, hurricanes. So there is a whole host of things that we're looking at in response to a rapidly warming climate, such as a $1 billion seawall that would literally ring the old historic district.
Ben and Tony, one of the things that we see more frequently where you are than in many other places is sunny day flooding. And Tony, tell me what that means in Charleston. I see pictures, but I have not been there to witness it.
Yeah, sunny day flooding is such an optimistic name for something, right? So 30 years ago, when I started reporting in Charleston, we might have a flood at high tide maybe once or twice a year. Now we're seeing them 50 to 60, maybe even more times some years. And this happens when the tide is higher than the land, and literally the ocean begins to spill into Charleston, whether it's raining or not.
And is that one of the reasons why they want to raise the seawall?
The Army Corps of Engineers actually wants to build a seawall, mainly because to prevent storm surges. So it's actually not really addressing that incremental rise in sea level. It's really focusing on these storms. But of course, you know, as the seas rise, those storm surges are going to get worse as well. So it's sort of a mix.
And Ben, I have been to Wilmington and seen some of the effects of sunny day flooding. But, you know, one time when I was there earlier this year, it was a time of the king tide, which is when the moon is full and close to the earth and has the biggest effect. And I actually heard something on WHQR Morning News warning me that there could be flooding downtown. What is that like there?
Yeah. So Wilmington's waterfront, you know, it's just a few feet above the high tide of the river, and there's a number of events that can cause, you know, flooding up onto the Riverwalk on downtown Wilmington. One of those is a king tide, and we have sunny day flooding all the time. And you know, it's interesting, across the river, if you've been to Wilmington, you know the battleship USS North Carolina is there, and there's hundreds of acres of debatably developable land. And there was recently a sort of a public forum for developers who wanted to build there, and there were protesters and there were pro-development people, but it was a clear day. And as we were leaving, the parking lot of the battleship North Carolina was completely underwater due to sunny day flooding. And we saw reporters, you know, taking off their shoes and turning their jeans into clam diggers and stuff like that. So it's, if you're in Wilmington, or especially in the beach towns like Carolina Beach or Riceville Beach, you are familiar with this phenomenon.
You're in the Wilmington area, and what are some of the climate issues that you guys are seeing in your community, and what sorts of reactions are you seeing?
Well, certainly the beach renourishment conversation is front and center here, because it is the number one, you know, revenue driver for tourism. It's why people come here. We have also been looking at sort of the head-on collision between development and the just increasing amount of rain and powerful storms. You know, a lot of these development requirements revolve around stormwater management and what's called a 100-year storm possibility. And when those 100-year storms start to happen every couple of years, some of those requirements seem a bit outmoded. So we've seen a lot of debate over that, and in terms of where we should be building. You know, Brunswick County is one of the, if not the fastest growing county in North Carolina, one of the fastest growing regions in the country. So it's a collision that is, it seems unavoidable, but the conversation has been slow to actually happen.
Carrie, what are you seeing in your area?
As a station, we are looking at what municipalities are doing to make their own climate initiatives. We're seeing Winston-Salem and Greensboro set their own climate action plans. And we're basically following, how are they doing that? What are their plans? For instance, in Greensboro, they just hired their first chief sustainability officer, and she's tasked with this strategic clean energy plan, getting city council to adopt it. And it's something that the city has been working on before she came on board. But it's things like that we're seeing in Winston-Salem. They are putting solar on their very first municipal building. And so what we're doing is following what some of these municipalities are doing, what some of their climate action plans are, how they're going about it.
Well, I want to follow up on something that Carrie mentioned, that the local authorities there are taking steps. They have climate plans and all of that. Here in North Carolina, under former Governor Pat McCrory, North Carolina really resisted federal efforts to respond to climate change. And when President Obama announced a plan to cut power plant emissions, McCrory joined 23 other states in filing a lawsuit questioning the EPA's authority. That's changed under Governor Roy Cooper. It has been a different story. He issued executive order 84 years ago and several other orders since then. And last year, Cooper reached a compromise with Republican leaders of the General Assembly on energy reforms called House Bill 951. Celeste, you've been following this. What is HB 951 and why is it important to North Carolina?
House Bill 951 is a monumental bipartisan legislation. The legislation says that North Carolina has to reduce its statewide emissions by 70% by 2030 compared to 2005 levels and reach carbon neutrality by 2050. The primary way to do that is by working with Duke Energy, as they are the largest utility provider in the state. So right now, Duke Energy is in the process of creating its carbon reduction plan. Back in May, it submitted its draft, and right now, the State Utilities Commission is working on that draft and holding public comment. The Utilities Commission has until the end of this year to finalize what Duke's plan will be.
Do we have any sense of what the outcome of this plan will be, and is it permanent?
In HB 951, it actually allows for flexibility. Every 2 years, the State Utilities Commission will be able to revisit Duke's plan in order to implement any new or best available technology.
So, Tony, in South Carolina, your governor has not been such a champion of renewable energy as we have seen here in North Carolina. And I think it prompts a question. How have you approached covering global warming and climate change in a state where denial runs so strong?
David, that's a really important question because, denial certainly is strong, except I think on the coast that's begun to change. And in part because we've just been hammered year after year with these big, unusual, weird storms, these, thousand-year storms that happen over and over, which sort of sends the message that, hey, maybe something is happening. So I think you're starting to see a little bit of a break in that denial. That said, I think it's really important when you're covering climate change to, write stories in such a way that just doesn't immediately turn people away. And that's a little bit of an art because, I don't know about you, but I'm really into climate change issues. But even I get turned off when I see the latest story about the world's coming to an end. So when I'm writing a story, sometimes I will write a story that just hits people over the head. Other times I try to approach it, a story, by remembering that there's beauty out there and that we could lose it, or that there's just something kind of awe-inspiring about the world in which we live.
Kerry, you've mentioned some of the communities in your area that have plans and have done things. Winston-Salem, Greensboro, and Boone all come to mind.
Yes, the little town of Boone in Watauga County. They're very fortunate, even though they are a rural community, they're very fortunate because Appalachian State University is up there as well, and they're doing several climate initiatives and research, and so they've been partnering with them on some of those. But the town itself has really taken some strong initiative here. Earlier this year, they became the first municipality in North Carolina to achieve 100% renewable energy in government facilities using solar and hydroelectric power. They are electrifying their transportation fleet, their police vehicles, and they're really coming together as a town. They have a new renewable energy plan goal that they're setting forth for 2050. And a big part of that is getting community input. And so they're really coming together as a small town. And it's interesting to see that dynamic.
Well, thanks to our panel, Celeste Gracia, environment reporter at WUNC, Kerry Brown, reporter and host at WFDD, Ben Schachman, the news director at WHQR, and Tony Bartlemy, senior projects reporter at the Post and Courier in Charleston. Thanks, everyone. As we contemplate our changing climate, efforts to prevent the worst effects are in high gear, at the global level down to the local level. And we're doing more as states and local communities to adapt to what we can't avoid. Many people I talk to are optimistic, like state climatologist Kathy Dello.
There's still time for us to do something, both on the mitigation side to slow the problem down, and also on the resilience side. So all hope is not lost. We can imagine a better state. We can imagine better communities that are climate resilient and climate thriving. So I don't want people to think that all hope is lost or the clock has run out, because we certainly have the time and the will to do something.
People often ask me, what can I do? Let me leave you with this advice from climate communicator Susan Joy Hassel.
Individually, you can vote for leaders that will take climate action at every single level. Engage in that civic action. Call your leaders. Let them know that this is something you care about. You can also volunteer and support groups that are taking climate action. Opt for renewable energy. And then there's all the kinds of individual actions. Fly less, drive an electric car or an efficient car. Vote with your dollars. In your banking, in your investments, in your purchases.
And stay informed. I'm climate reporter David Borax, and you've been listening to a special report, Adapt: Changing Climate in the Carolinas.
Adapt: Changing Climate in the Carolinas was hosted and produced at WFAE in Charlotte by David Borax. We had production and editing help from Greg Collard and Eric Teal at WFAE, Bethany Chafin at WFDD in Winston-Salem, and Helen Chickering at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Our climate coverage is supported by the One Earth and Salamander Funds.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.